Radio Reverb Brighton Festival 2017. Now, all of the news, reviews, and what not to miss at Brighton Festival 2017 with Rebecca Sandals on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, the only station on air with a dedicated Brighton Festival hour.
You're listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM on digital radio and online at radioreverb.com. I'm Rebecca Sandals and this is Tuesday's Brighton Festival special. Brighton Festival rules the Reverb airwaves from 5 to 6pm Monday to Friday during May and is repeated at 10pm and 8am. Every day we're looking behind the scenes at the festival, meeting some of the performers, creators and the people who make it happen. Today I'll be hearing about The Hum. That's an app that allows you to explore and see Brighton in a whole new way. We find out about the Storytelling Army coming with a soapbox to a corner near you later in the month. And we'll be having a look through festival events over the next 48 hours. And we'll be hearing about two of the installations running through festival, Virgin Territory at Onca and Kathy Pilkington's haunting take on dolls at Brighton University. That's all to come in the next hour with me, Rebecca Sandals, during our festival radio special, supported by Brighton Festival here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. And let's start with an act that took to the stage at Hangleton Community Centre at the weekend. It's the Sussex-based Electric Youth Ensemble with You Are Not Alone. Electric Youth Ensemble there, who performed at Hangleton Community Centre last weekend. You know, I like them rather a lot, and I think we'll try and squeeze in a little bit more before the end of the hour today. You're listening to Radio Reverb's Festival Special, and one of the things I love about Brighton Festival is that it always offers up some sort of new way of experiencing art and performance. This year, amongst several original commissions, there's an app called The Hum, and it offers a new way to experience Brighton. The festival programme pitches The Hum as half cinema, half reality, and a groundbreaking event providing a new way of seeing and relating to the urban environment, revisiting the mundane activities of everyday life. Well, it sounds interesting, I thought. So I went along to meet the man who conceived and created the piece to find out more.
I'm Nick Sandiland, and I run a company called Flexer & Sandiland with my partner, Yael Flexer. We are looking at interactions that happen throughout the city between everyday folk and the everyday actions that that take place there. So normally when you go to see a film or theatre, you go to see a big event on stage about a very profound thing. And it's accompanied by all the things that you have associated with stage lighting and sound. Let's say you go and see a film in theatre, you have a soundtrack, you have narration, you have camera work, you have all of those things that draw attention to particular aspects of life. So we've decided to take some of those techniques, such as soundtrack and narration, and dispense with the theatre. And we've produced a route where people can navigate through. They can go and have a look at actions and everyday events that take place in these spaces.
Okay, so yeah. In order to experience The Hum, which is the name of the piece, in order to experience The Hum, you simply download an app to your phone and get out and about and follow a route. What happens during your journey around Brighton then?
Okay, so we've got 15 different places. They're everyday places. The whole thing about The Hum is that we're looking at everyday events and we're using film and theatrical techniques to elevate these things to more than the everyday. I mean, we go about our lives and most of the things that we see are very boring and we pass them by. But as a subject, we believe they're very, very interesting if you look at them in the right way. So we've got these 15 locations, and they are things like getting on an escalator, going in a lift, catching a bus, waiting for a bus, crossing a road, things that you just don't think about. And we've directed people to these locations, and we've asked four different writers who write about dance and performance to create soundtracks for each of these locations. So they're sort of poetic reflections.
Okay, so you're not looking at your phone at the location, you're listening to a soundtrack to accompany the live action that's going on around you.
Yeah. I mean, we were thinking a while back of making a piece for mobile phone, And so I put lots of video onto the phone and tried out different things and walked around town to see what it would be like. And most of the time, what was on the phone was okay, it was, you know, very well filmed, but it's tiny and tinny and not very interesting. And in fact, when we started looking around, the everyday actions in front of us were far more captivating when you stop to look, because most people don't look at these things. They just pass them by or look at their phone to distract themselves.
They're not looking around them
at
all.
Yeah, they're not looking around.
So it does fit in with the everyday epic theme that Kate Tempest has set.
Totally, totally, yeah.
And you've got original music for the piece. How did that come about?
Well, that's with our fantastic composer, James Keane. He's worked with us in the past. I was interested in this sort of reflective quality. You know, you go and sit in a cinema or a theatre, it goes dark, and you're given the time to sit and contemplate. And that's what we wanted to do in the real world, where we don't do that so much. And I talked to him about that sort of reflective type of music, and we both love Ravel. Because of that, it's sort of unresolved music. It lets you dwell in the space. And that was our sort of starting point, really. So he's produced a lot of quite minimal soundtracks that just give space for being.
And how long do you expect people to take to do this? Is it something that you go around the sites, that the recommendation is do it all in an afternoon, or is it you can dip in and out at different locations?
What? It's completely up to you. You've got a map, you've got 15 locations. Each place takes about between 2 and 5 minutes or so to experience. This will carry on going forever. Ideally, we'd like you to experience it during the festival time. But you can have this app and you can be on the bus and suddenly the bus stops and you think, what am I going to do with this 5 minutes? And just look for a location on there, pop along to it and listen to the text and the music and experience what's happening in front of you, then nip back on the bus again.
And presumably it's one of those things which every time you could do it at the same location several times and the experience would be different because it's life in front of you.
It would do, yeah. I mean, some of the locations are dependent on the shop times. So we've got a few in the shopping centre, which is chaotic and noisy, but that's a lovely place to stop in and just watch other people and experience that little point in time.
Churchill Square
is one. Yeah. And we have Elevated Boots and Small Batch Cafe. The toilet in there is quite an interesting place.
Okay.
Yes. No, they're very up for that. Recommend that one.
Recommending a toilet experience. Okay. Yeah.
I'll say no more about that. You need to go and experience it.
So what kind of response have you had to date from it? Because it's very unusual to be sort of saying people get an app and go and stand and experience some music in the space. What's the response been?
Very good so far. A lot of people have taken this up and been travelling around town. Very encouraging feedback. People really loved it and found it very different. And particularly the writers. I must say something about the writers on there. We have four writers. We have Donald Tutera, who is a dance writer, writes quite often for The Times. We have Wendy Houston, who's a performer and a fantastic writer in her own sphere. Maria Oshodi, who is visually impaired theatre director, and she comes from her own particular angle, which is very refreshing. I mentioned the toilet, but the toilet is written from somebody who's visually impaired. So we get a different experience of a familiar place. It's a sense of putting yourself into somebody else's body and experiencing the world through that.
So how does one go about getting to experience the world in another way, in a world that we probably all see most days wandering around Brighton, never actually take in with the level of concentration that the hum will, you know, aim to take us there in a different way? What's the way of getting hold of the app?
You can download it if you go to the website, to the Brighton Festival website, and just look for The Hum. On there, there's a page, and you just click a button, and you can download it. If you navigate there from your mobile, then it will go straight onto your mobile. It'll run on cross-platform, so very easy to download. Just make sure you've got a Wi-Fi signal, because it's got quite a lot of, it's got about an hour's worth of text and music on there.
So when you're downloading it, you need to
Yeah, when you download it, and then you're free to roam after that. It's then in your pocket, and don't forget your headphones. That's the most important thing. And if you don't have headphones, then pop down to the Dome foyer, and there are about 4 or 5 sets there you can borrow, just sign them out. But I recommend close-cupped headphones to get the best experience, so you don't get too many buskers in the background.
Great. Nick, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Nick Sandiland there talking to me earlier about The Hum and a bit of headphone recommendations from him. And you can find out about The Hum on the brightonfestival.org website and download the app from there. Now let's have a bit more music. Here's Brighton's Kudo Blue with Drink Alone.
Festival 2017. All of the news, reviews, and what not to miss at Brighton Festival 2017. Radio Reverb, the only station on air with a dedicated Brighton Festival hour.
I'm Rebecca Sandals, and still to come this hour on the Brighton Festival special, we'll be hearing about artist Kathy Pilkington's The Life Room, which uses dolls in unexpected and challenging ways at the University of Brighton on Grand Parade. Before that, let's hear this about the Storytelling Army. It's a collective of Brighton people from all walks of life, including those who are homeless. We all have a story to tell, and this collective has been preparing theirs for pop-up performances the bank holiday weekend, Friday 26th. To Sunday the 28th of May.
I've got my soapbox, we'll travel.
The Storytelling Army is a collection of people from all walks of life who will pop up all over Brighton telling a story that celebrates the everyday epic. So the everyday epic looks at us as human beings, like what we do on a daily basis, and really celebrating those things that we do, those achievements, those small little achievements that we have, whether that is today I am sober, or I have managed to take my kids to school and I suffer from depression, or whether it's my first day of paid work. Whatever that everyday epic is for you, it's a chance to kind of celebrate that and tell that story. So for us, this concept was really about finding ways of making the arts more social. So going into non-theatre spaces and identifying communities you want to take work into, but also removing the financial barrier. So these stories will be free, like you don't have to have any money to see these stories. In Brighton, there's a lot of issues in terms of drug use and addiction. There's lots of homelessness and vulnerably housed people. And so we started to identify different organisations and charities that we'd want to work with in partnership and support to create that army of storytellers.
It's just a genius idea. It's all voluntary and it helps people in recovery or wanting to get into recovery through creative-based groups and creative writing and drama. Music, all sorts, and it's fantastic. It's literally saved my life along with others.
Everyone in recovery has a story, you know. We're not mundane people, generally speaking. It'd be really exciting and interesting to see how people's stories develop from possibly being a very internalised situation to developing it as a story, as something that can be performed.
I'm feeling extremely excited about going and standing up in front of people and telling my story. I think it's a great idea. I'm really excited for it.
Why are we still here?
Some of the voices there of the Storytelling Army, who will be popping up around Brighton to tell their stories over the bank holiday weekend. Keep an eye and an ear out for them. You're listening to Radio Reverb's Brighton Festival special, supported by Brighton Festival. So let's have a bit of music now and a track that's taken from that oh so Brighton story, Quadrophenia. It is, of course, The Who with Sea and Sand. It's a track I don't want to stop. I love that. And I have to say that Alan Wares from The Albion Roar and I were both...
We were jumping around the studio like a couple of loonies.
We just lacked our parkas there. And there were parkas on Vespers ahead of the Albion's
the motorcade
parade.
The motorcade for the Albion parade. Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, it was how very bright and sunshine, mods, parkas, the Albion. It was wonderful.
We'll reference that again in a moment, because I'm going to have a chat with you and have a little look at what's happening for the festival over the next 48 hours. But, The Who, pull myself together, back in the studio, away from the sea and sand, and let's talk about the visual artist Kathy Pilkington. Now, she creates an unsettling sculptures using dolls, mutant animals and textiles. Her work, The Life Rooms at the University of Brighton Gallery, explores memories of childhood, representations of women in art and the subconscious. And Melita Dennett went to the gallery to meet her.
My name's Kathy Pilkington. The show that I've put on in Brighton Festival is called The Life Rooms, and it's two fairly large installations in the University Gallery space. There are two very distinct rooms and they've got a very different kind of character.
I have to say, just walking around here, it's dark. It's a very dark exhibition. There are dolls, there are mutant animals, there are nightmarish scenes. What is it that you're trying to convey with this exhibition?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people say that to me. I think it's also very beautiful and formally very carefully considered. So although there are these dark narrative aspects to the work, it's not the whole story. I also don't think there's anything that's beautiful that doesn't have a dark side either. So I'm talking about life, really. I'm talking about what it's like to be alive, what it's like to be in a body, what it's like to think about life, what it's like to have children, what it's like to live and know that you're going to die, all the kind of basic human questions that we have.
Much of the exhibition is based around dolls. There is something uncanny about a doll, isn't there? On the one hand, you've got the kind of the childlike simplicity of a doll and the pleasure of a doll that a child might have. On the other side, you've got that uncanniness of the human, not human. It looks like that's something you're really playing with in this exhibition.
I've always been really interested in inanimate objects that pretend to be alive. And that might be your grandma's ornament, a doll, or a piece of classical Greek sculpture. I've always been really, really interested in Freud's essay on the uncanny. And in the 80s, I saw Mike Kelly's Uncanny Show the first time he staged it, and was massively relieved that someone had taken on, I think at the time, that kind of figuration wasn't really being used in art. And it was very, very out of fashion. And I felt very kind of out of step with what was going on. And Mike Kelly's exhibition was a real kind of like a life buoy to me, because it talked about figuration in the whole of culture, not just in fine art, in the way that we have always had the impulse to make figures, whether they be fertility symbols or toys or icons, you know, religious objects. So it gave me permission really to carry on with the things that had always interested me.
Can we pop around the corner, because there is a most striking part of the installation around here, and you do have to kind of weave your way around these things, and you see things which actually catch you quite by surprise. So we've got a baby here tied to a post being savaged by a rabbit.
that's the wonderful story of the tar baby. That's from Brer Rabbit. This structure is called Harmonium, and it contains a lot of initially separate narrative scenes that I'd shown on their own in their own right. This is like a compilation, almost like an album or a book of collected poems, where they're all contained together in one structure, and the structure is made in a kind of roughshod kind of garage furniture manner. It's made out of pegboard and ribbon curtains and things that I associate with growing up in the 70s.
So around this corner here is a doll, life size, of a child looking very intently into a mirror on an antique dressing table.
This piece is called Curio, and the sculpture of the figure, like you say, it's life-size. She's a little bit like those charity boxes that we used to around.
Yes.
I've always been really interested in those things. And she's also, she's like some of the ornaments that she surrounds herself with. So I was looking at a lot of those historical pictures of children where they're dressed as mini adults and they're contained and constricted and presented as these objects, and I'm really interested in that's one of the things I love about dolls, because you can talk about the object and the subject at the same time. And here she's very directly sitting beside the objects that perhaps she's collected and looking at herself in the mirror. So you've got a whole disorientating scene that you enter into. You're really pulled into it and you're really engaged by it, and at the same time you're kind of repelled by it as well. And that's the thing I'm really trying to do in all my work.
I'm really getting a sense of the gothic from you here. But there's something interesting as well in that she actually looks at you when you position yourself in the right place. She's not looking at herself, she's looking at you.
I'm not quite sure where she's looking, actually. I think she's kind of refusing to fix her gaze. She's sort of looking at a space in between everything. So I think it's hard for her to look at you, and it's hard for her to look at herself as well. She's sort of in between.
Can we move through to the second room?
Sure.
I'm getting a sense in this second room of a homage to other artists here. So we've got some doll figurines, which are like Degas' ballet dancer.
Right, yeah.
There's a Magritte tribute around
That's
the corner.
Right, yeah.
I see a bit of Salvador Dali in there as well. Different kind of style that you've approached in this room.
This work is much more recent. The work I made next door is made probably about 5 years ago now. And this is the work that I'm actually engaged with now. You're right, the starting point of these dolls, they're called Degas dolls 1 to 5, and they're taken from the poses anyway, are taken from Degas waxes that he made Privately in his studio, they weren't ever made to be shown in an art gallery, and they were cast posthumously, and they were cast in bronze, and they were cast with their armatures still attached to them. So there was something really exciting, always something really exciting to me, because there's an element of the process that's still visible. They're not finished and presented on a plinth. You can get close to the artist and close to the making process. So, but these move aesthetically, they're a million miles away from the Degas dancers. They're not about gesture, they're not about messy clay like the work in the other room. They're much smoother, they're about the surfaces of dolls and dummies. And so we're moving into a slightly different territory that's it's less gestural.
So these five dolls are arranged on plinths, and there's a seating area around it and mirrors over there. They are naked, and they're also kind of mutated at the same time. Mm. Are you making a point here about us as the observers of the female form here, or not?
Well, certainly all that content is in the work. But, I would question, are they naked? Because if we look at these, we don't know if they're naked or if they're clothed or stitched.
Okay,
because
yes,
they're made
yes.
of a variety of different materials. And some of them look like dolls' legs, which are very dumb, unkind of modelled things that just suggest a limb. Other parts of the body are very, very particular. Often the faces are blank as well, so they're kind of dumb and receptive to our projection. So I'm trying to make something that's really, really interesting and engaging, but at the same time slightly unsettling, because I think the body is unsettling. It's an unsettling thing. We live in our bodies. We are quite estranged by our bodies. The formal setup of this room is a replica of the RA, the Royal Academy Life Room, where this installation has been shown. So it was shown there 2 weeks ago. So it's come directly from there to here, which is very exciting, to have it in a very different kind of space, to have a shop window almost. Of course, there are lots and lots of interesting questions about voyeurism and observation and the female model as well. Yeah. So these benches are a replica of the RA Life Room benches, and they've been made by the students in interior architecture here fantastically.
What are you hoping an audience will take away from this?
I hope the audience will really engage with the work, think about how the work is made, not just the image of what that work is, that they'll think about the processes involved, that they'll come and draw from the work and think about that. And also, I think some of these ideas that people are bringing, that this work is strange or unsettling, that they might spend a bit longer with it and actually see that there is a logic and a beauty and a kind of formal constraint in the work as well. It's not just about this sort of unbridled emotion.
Cathy Pilkington there, talking to Melita Dennett about Life Rooms at the University of Brighton Gallery. And you're listening to Radio Reverb's Festival Special. Let's have a quick look now at what's happening over the next couple of days. And I spoke to him briefly a moment ago because I've got a bit of help here from Alan Wares again from Reverb's Albion Raw show and Move On Up show as well. And he is
producing
for me today. Firstly, are you in a condition to have a look through the listings of what's coming up in Brighton Festival after the events of Sunday evening?
I have eyes, if that's what you mean. No, everything's fine. It was a beautiful day. Obviously, nothing to do with the festival. So, but all those that want to hear about the festival, just bear with me for about, you know, sort of 45 seconds here. It was something obviously massive for the city. I mean, we've got people saying, oh, you're having a parade for finishing second. Now, this is a parade that was actually something that was for the city. It's the past 20 years. Now, I'm going to bring your stuff in here, Rebecca. People don't know you're a Charlton fan. They themselves are going through, well, not for the first time, the mire. So when it comes to appreciating what a football club can do for a community and the targets and the goals that the football club achieves are met, then it's time for a city parade.
Absolutely. And I was at home, and I live approximately, and I looked it up on my phone to work out how far I am from Hove Lawns, 2.5 miles.
Mm.
And I opened my windows when Anthony Knockhart came on stage and I could hear the noise from Hove Lawns in my flat.
Noisy lot, aren't we? Yes, it's that kind of hero worship. I mean, you know, the sort of international hero worship that we have that's very much a part of the city. I'd say anywhere between, depends on which reports you believe it's anywhere between 60 and 100,000 turned up. It was a perfect day for the weather-wise. It was nice and warm. The club put on an extra special show. For those who were inconvenienced by it, sorry, too bad. We were having a party. That's what Brighton does.
It didn't seem... I mean, I was looking at to check how the roads were doing, and it seemed like most people got the message.
So
a great time was had by all?
Certainly those who support Brighton and Hove Albion, yes. It was a huge day. It was an enormous day. Like I said, the club put on an excellent show. We've had these open-top parades before, and they've been good, and there's lots of flag waving, but this one was a bit good. The club spent a few quid on this. But the point is that I think that the city as a whole will benefit, you know, from August onwards. In fact, even from now onwards, I can say for Albion Raw, for the Radio Reverb, we've already had requests from international press. You know, we're almost like the go-to radio show for talking to Albion fans from, we've had people from Spain, we've had people from the Far East talking to us. So Reverb could go international very soon, just by the fact that Brighton and Hove Albion is now a Premier League club.
Okay, I want one number from you, because we're going to finish Albion back to festival.
Sure.
That's the position that Brighton and Hove Albion will finish next season.
I would be delighted with 16. Anything lower than that number, better still.
Marvellous. Lower as in a lower number, not lower down.
A lower number.
Absolutely.
One would suit me down. Would suit me perfectly.
16, we'll see. Above that, and the drinks are on, Al.
You're on.
Marvellous. So let's get back to Brighton Festival business now and take a look through a few of the offerings over the next couple of days.
Yeah, we've got tonight, if you're listening to this live on Tuesday, we've got there's Songs for the End of the World, which would be just typical that, you know, if this sort of thing were to come true, that Brighton just gets the Premier League and then we're spoiled by Armageddon. Tickets are still available for the one-off show by Dom Coyote and the Blood Monies. Reverb heard from Dom here on the festival show yesterday, and he explained how the piece of futuristic tale of Armageddon and a spaceman... It does sound lovely, this, doesn't it? When the apocalypse arrives, astronaut Jim Walters is left suspended in orbit on his way to Mars, broadcasting songs for the end of the world to a silent Earth. Well, at least, I suppose at the very least, there'll be some peace and quiet.
And there are tickets available for that at Theatre Royal tonight, Tuesday night. There's also a chance to catch up on several events running throughout festival over the next couple of days. An example being In Their Shoes, that's a poetry trail at a number of locations across the city, including the Jubilee Library. And I put on a suede boot to hear poetry in my ear at that one.
Yes, we've heard about that. There was no soul attached, was there?
Oh.
Sorry. There's also Ibek Duban's installation They Online at Fabrica. The piece explores how does Turkey view the other, and by extension do we. In her multi-screen installation, Ibek Duban goes behind the scenes in Turkish society to provide a glimpse of her country's ethnic, religious and gender diversity and the everyday discrimination and resistance that it triggers. It's a free event, open from midday to 7 p.m. every day through to the bank holiday, Monday the 29th of May.
Let's do a quick reference of a couple of sold-out shows on Wednesday that it's worth checking if there are box office returns. Jeremy Hardy of Radio 4, Theatre Royal on Wednesday, sell out.
I always miss him every time.
Another one that's sold out, you've got details on, but check for returns, is at the Spire, I believe. No Dogs, No Indians.
Yeah, again, do check. But it's a world premiere piece, actually, exploring how far people go to resist oppression. It's three intertwining stories explore the effects and legacy of the British in India to mark the 70th anniversary of Indian independence. But yes, do check with box office. You never know.
So finally, let's look at a piece that there are tickets definitely available for. Some classical music on Wednesday lunchtime at the Theatre Royal. And pianist Tyler Hay performs there at 1 p.m. Festival programme says of Tyler... The fearless virtuosity of Tyler Hay has propelled him to the top of his class. Last year, he won the gold medal at the Royal Northern College of Music. And that's Tyler Hay, who's performing at the Theatre Royal on Wednesday at 1 p.m. You're listening to Radio Reverb's Brighton Festival special, supported by Brighton Festival. And now, as promised at the start of the hour, here's another track from Sussex's own Electric Youth Ensemble, a group of talented young people brought together by Audio Active. You're listening to Radio Reverb's Brighton Festival special with me, Rebecca Sandals, and that was the Electric Youth Ensemble with Let Go. Virgin Territory is a dance piece for video which explores the impact of young people, the impact on young people of selfie culture and how the internet can shape their everyday lives. It's on at the Onca Gallery until Saturday, and Melita Dennett went to meet its creator, Charlotte Vincent, as it was being set up.
I'm Charlotte Vincent. I'm the artistic director of Vincent Dance Theatre, and I am in Onca Gallery, and we're just doing the get-in for Vincent Dance Theatre's Virgin Territory, which is a premiere commissioned by Brighton Festival of a film installation, multi-screen film installation of a show that I made last year, which has four fantastic local teenagers in and four very accomplished adult performers.
Sounds like it deals with a difficult subject. It's about the sexualisation of young women and that need for constant performance and the idea of being scrutinised, filmed, photographed.
That's right. Well, as you know, it's a problem, I think, that digital natives have. We have a whole generation growing up fully engaged with their digital devices as much as with real life. And I think the issue for young women specifically is that they're getting very sort of sexy, hot imagery that they're supposed to aspire to or replicate in their real lives. And they're posting things online and being groomed online, unfortunately, and coming across all sorts of pornography online. That is affecting the way they see themselves, the way that they feel about their self-worth, that it's sort of not okay to be natural anymore. They're aspiring, not everybody obviously, but a lot of teenage girls are aspiring to a completely unreal image of how women should look and behave. And I think sort of MTV video, music video culture isn't helping that. Advertising isn't helping that. Men's and women's magazines who, you know, all about body image, that's not helping that. And unlike myself, as I hurtle towards 50, young girls and young women today, I think, because they've got a constant stimulation through their mobile devices and their laptops and their tablets and their phones, they are bombarded by images that they are aspiring to that are completely unreachable. It's not possible to look like that most of the time. And on top of that, young boys and men are consuming, we know, a lot more pornography than they used to, and our whole society, I think, has been sort of pornographied, if that's a kind of word. So the mainstream culture of music and advertising, all the rest of it, when I grew up, wasn't quite as infected by these over-sexy images. And I personally, as an adult, as a mother, as an artist, just feel like it's overload. How do you negotiate that? So Virgin Territory is about not a return to a virgin territory, or it's a play on the word virgin, obviously, but it's about, we can't undo the digital world, we can't stop the internet, we wouldn't want to. It's brilliant in many ways, it's a positive force, but it also has a very dark side. And a lot of girls and young women and boys and men are falling into the trap of thinking that it's real life, and then applying the rules of what they see online to real life. Or the opposite, actually, that a lot of young girls have a life online that they can't live up to in real life. So they might present themselves pouting and looking really sexy with crop tops and push-up bras online on their Instagram or their Facebook accounts, and actually in real life they can't play it out. So like you said, there's this performing for the camera that we didn't have when we were growing up. And I'm not making a nostalgic piece, I'm just provoking thought around this subject.
It is a dance piece. It's an interesting subject for dance. You must have thought through, how can I actually portray this through that medium?
Yeah, I mean, I make dance theatre, so what's been really interesting is working with young people in the process of making this piece. And what we've done is, in the very early stages of research, I gathered interviews and talked to young women and girls about their experience just of living today with their digital devices and how they feel about this sort of hyper-sexualized culture that we live in. So I gathered these testimonies. And we used them in the making of the live work that we performed in London last November. And actually, interestingly, making the film version, the testimonies have come back in, and they're very present. So the collaborators, who are remaining anonymous, because obviously I don't want to expose some of the bad experiences that they've had, they're back in the installation, channeled by the adult performers. And a lot of their original voices actually ended up in the soundtrack, which is also a brilliant soundtrack by Jules Maxwell, a composer that I've worked with. So it really has been a collaboration between young people and adults, and their voices are very much in the work, describing their experiences. And as an adult, if you come in and you think it's a little bit paranoid or a little bit over the top, actually, I can stand by the work, because this is young people's voices telling me directly that they've had bad experiences, that they're surprised by, you know, when they wear certain clothing, the response that they get. And so what we need to do is educate young men to control themselves.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? And you did kind of you touched on something that I was wondering there. You know, you and I, we're not digital natives. We didn't grow up with the internet, and I was wondering if maybe some people might think, well, actually, you know, you're just old school, and you're being a bit preachy about this. And why don't you just let young people get on with what they know and what they do?
Yeah, I think that's why my response was just as it is, because I think the young people have told me that their digital nativism, if that's the right word, is affecting how they live, and they're under a constant pressure. And I think the piece is a provocation. It's not a preach, and all I'm trying to do with Virgin Territory is highlight the dangers of the internet and the dangers of hypersexualisation, and question what we're going to do about it. I don't have any answers. You know, the internet's not going away. I think, obviously, as a lifelong feminist, I've been campaigning against that kind of imagery of women for a long time, and I think the thing that works in this particular installation is that the young women, Maya, Millie and Alicia, who are in the work, they're phenomenally strong. They hold their own in partner work in terms of dance. They dance with the men, they dance with the women. One of them's a footballer, one of them's a gymnast, one of them's a martial artist. And we show all that. So it's not all doom and gloom. We show that young women are strong and powerful, they find their voice, but we also show them as victims of grooming and of online abuse and sexual harassment in the street. Every day, women and young girls are being subjected to this. That's not hysteria on my behalf as a female maker. It is life. And I think that's the pressure that I'm talking about. The confusion lies around, they sort of buy into it and then they sort of run away from it. And I think that those hormonal years, like 12 to 14, 15, you know, some of the girls that I interviewed at 15 were talking about their experiences at 13 as though they were old women. You know, they were kind of going, oh, you know, all that time ago. They're only 15. You know, their experiences have been appalling, actually. That's why it's quite a dark piece. But there is some humour in it. There is some sort of piss-taking, as there always is in my work around British culture. There is a dark humour that always seeps back in when we make something. And it's quite exciting. You know, there's four big screens in a room, and it is dance theatre with text as well. The choreography is very exciting at times. It's very minimal at other times. It's a low-tech presentation of quite a complex, layered piece of work.
Do you feel a degree of frustration that it's a gallery space, it's a dance performance, it's in the Brighton Festival? Who is likely to come to it? Well, probably people who agree with you in the first place.
Yeah, it's a good question. We're running engagement workshops. We've actually done a lot of engagement so far in Brighton. So we've worked with Oasis, we've worked with DV8, we've worked with lots of different groups that we're building relationships with. Audio Active, we hope, will come down. So it's not just preaching to the converted. We're really looking to extend our audience through working on stage, on film and online, beyond the usual white middle class dance audience who might go to the Dome. And I think, you know, Brighton Festival's really up for that. That's partly why they've commissioned it. Obviously, Kate Tempest's festival is doing that as a whole. It's trying to invite the community in and not preach the converted, but just involve them and say art is for everyone. And that's something in my practice over 26 years that I've always done. What we're trying to do as a company at the moment is meld sort of the high art bit with the community practice and make work that has people's, you know, real life voices in, and also gets out of the arty venues into the community, either online or through our workshopping programme. And it's working.
That's Charlotte Vincent talking about Virgin Territory at Onca Gallery. And our reporters Alicia Theobald and Holly Simpson went to see Virgin Territory and came into the studio to tell Melita Dennett what they thought about it.
As a woman who has obviously grown up using the internet most of my life, actually, I definitely picked up on the misconception of beauty and how you're expected to look a certain way. You're supposed to look feminine if you're a woman. You can't look any other different. And I think that's something that's not going away anytime soon, which is a real shame. But yeah, I definitely picked up on that, and I have to say it made a really big impact watching some of those videos, especially because the woman was actually a man dressed up with this distorted mask on, this blonde wig and a dress.
Oh,
and
wow.
I think, yeah, it just was really strange, but it made such an impact on me, I have to say.
Yeah, and my bit was like more the fact that this girl was being groomed at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I've ever been groomed, but it's so easy to meet random people online.
Sure.
And that kind of hit me quite. I was like, yeah, it's really, really easy.
Because these are actually all taken from real life, individual personal testimonies. Did that give it much more impact for you?
Oh, definitely. I think you could tell just by the movement and like the way they were, like, or with the screen, because they literally looked directly at the camera and you felt like it was just you and them, and they were telling you their story through what they were doing.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting how they used interpretive dance for a lot of the movements. And in fact, three of the young girls who were in it were standing in front of us and they were watching it.
Oh, and wow.
Yeah.
Really cool just to see them. They were dressed so nicely as well, like from what they were showing on the thing, I was a bit like, whoa. Because you could, they looked a bit different, obviously. So I was a bit like, oh, these are the same people.
Mm.
Do you think it was courageous for them to do it?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, some of the things they were doing, like standing and crying, just like a close-up of their face, it was really powerful.
Mm. So it sounds like a very effective installation there. You'd recommend it, would you?
Oh, yeah, I definitely recommend it, especially just to everyone, obviously, women, men, especially
yeah,
maybe more
men.
To
get it more out there as well, just the way the media does affect young people. That
yeah.
Probably don't realise how bad it is.
The awareness is really important, isn't it? I'd say.
Alicia Theobald and Holly Simpson there, and we have to thank here really the Thames Link Trains for supporting our Brighton Festival reporters. And Virgin Territory runs through to this coming Sunday, the 21st of May, at the Onkert Gallery. And believe it or not, that is it. That is the hour over. That's it for today's Radio Reverb Festival show. So thanks to all our guests, Nick Sandiland, Kathy Pilkington, Charlotte Vincent, reporters Alicia Theobald and Holly Simpson, and Alan Wares for being studio producer and helping me look ahead at what's happening over the next couple of days. And Radio Reverb's festival special, supported by Brighton Festival, is on air Monday through Friday, live at 5 p.m, repeated 10 p.m. and 8 a.m, and on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Melita Dennett and myself will be back tomorrow, but for today, thanks to you for listening, and keep on the lookout for the everyday epics in your life.